Moi
I'll call you on
Harible.
the phone.
Huh?
Call you on that phone, yeah.
You're on the phone now? Oh my God. I don't know what's going on now. Hey.
I was saying the most amazingly intelligent shit ever.
Figures.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
How's that?
Yeah. Oh, look at that background.
You like that?
Man, is that polka dots?
They're winking smiley faces. I thought that would be impressively metal.
Yeah, definitely.
I just did it because the you can't see behind me, but I didn't clean my studio, so.
Oh, all good.
Yeah.
So what's up?
Not much. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thanks.
Let's get this ball rolling. This sounds way better. All right. So welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. I got Mr. Mike Mowry on the other end of the non-Wi-Fi line. Mikey, how you doing?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Been a heck of a day, huh?
Eh, you know, not too bad. I can't even do a Boston accent, but that's where I'm visiting you from via the great... Not even the World Wide Web, via the Verizon LTE signal that
nice.
I have.
Nice. Oh, that's the same one that I abuse on a daily basis. What are you doing in Boston?
You know, here we are, weekend that – no, it's Monday, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Monday. Yeah.
Anyways, the week that we like to give thanks and celebrate our time here, I figured I'd come to Boston where the pilgrims first landed.
Right?
Since I'm so culturally sensitive.
Sure.
No, we're just on a little road trip.
Yeah? Wife and I. Picked Boston just because?
My wife went to college up here.
Aha.
She's a Northeasterner. I caught a gig last night.
What gig did you catch?
I was over in Albany, New York.
Go on.
I work with an artist called Ice Nine Kills.
Yes.
They happen to be performing at the... Upstate Concert Hall in Clifton, New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a little visit. Had to drop something off up that way. Caught the gig, and now here I am in Boston, off to Connecticut for the next couple days after this, and then back home to D.C.
Multitasking, man. Wow.
Yeah, baby.
Getting it all done in one big loop.
All the while trying to stay on top of work.
How's that going? Are you on top of it?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. It's thankfully it's a relatively slow week. Unfortunately, it's a slow week in some regards, but I've got my email up behind the screen here in case anything pressing comes in.
No problem. I understand. No problem. It looks like I wrote down a bunch of stuff that I know you're involved in on my whiteboard here. So if I look up once in a while, don't think that I'm being distracted or anything.
Is the top one like heaven or something? And you're looking up to the
way
to the gods?
Yes. I'm praising the whiteboard. I wrote down some things that I know that you're involved with, and I actually filled the first whiteboard. Pretty crazy. Wow. Where do I start with you? Good, clean, fun. Old school, hardcore, straight edge, vegan, posi core, late 90s. Did I get all that right?
It's pretty good. Into the 2000s.
Tell me all about it. Where were you? What were you involved with? Who did you know?
Not much. Not many people.
Good Clean Fun was awesome. That, dude.
Good Clean Fun was a good time.
Yeah, man.
Issa, who Mr. Issa, as he goes by in Good Clean Fun fame, one of my best friends, he and I met. I lived in Atlanta for a little while. I was going to school down there, and he was running a recording studio, Sleepless Nights. And we became pretty good friends and would travel back up to D.C. where he was from and see a lot of hardcore shows. Went to the Safari Club and a couple other cool places there in the early 90s. And then I left Atlanta and moved to California and finished school in California and then stayed out there and was running Fight Records, which was my label. And at one point he called me and said that, you know, he'd started, you know, a hardcore band. And I was like, dude, let me put out the record. And he's like, actually, the very first record I've already given to somebody else. And I was like, what the hell? You know, Here we are. We've been such good friends. I run this small label. He's like, well, the reason is I'm saving the next one for you. You know, he's got his way with manipulation. So he did a really good job of making me feel like, yeah, I got this.
Okay.
So, delivered me the second 7-inch, Who Shares Wins.
Okay, slow down. Where'd the first record go to?
It went to, what was the name of that kid's label based out of Chicago? His name was Anton. Good, clean, fun shopping for a crew. 7-inch. Let's just put that in the old Google machine here. Let's see. Discographies. This was released. Oh, was it Underestimated? That was the one. So Underestimated Records, based in Chicago. I don't know how Issa knew him.
Okay.
But gave him that record and then gave me the Who Shares Wins 7-inch. And then, you know, the band was just started. I mean, Issa had a recording studio, been a musician, hung out with all kind of the Battery, Damnation, Worlds Collide, that whole crew, hadn't really ever started a band on his own. And then for whatever reason, you know, just decided to start the band. And I don't think he thought it was going to go as far as it went. So he put out the first record and he had a bunch of guys who were in the DC area, and the bass player was a school teacher. And once it started to take off and he decided, hey, I want to tour, he asked me to join the band. Problem was, I didn't actually play any instruments. And so
I hear more and more of these stories. It blows my mind.
I mean, dude, it's really sort of funny to look back on now. And so I finished up school in Santa Barbara, stayed there for another couple years, had toured a couple times with a few bands. And on one of the tours going back through DC, Issa came to the show in DC or Baltimore and was like, hey, you know, I was kind of looking to get out of Santa Barbara. It's more or less a college town. At least the university area where we were is a college town. And I was either going to, I was kind of looking where to go. I was either going to move up to San Francisco, Berkeley area, or I wasn't even sure. And so he was like, look, I want the band to tour. You know, you should join. Right. And again, I was sort of like, I'm not entirely sure how this is going to work. He's like, look, dude, anyone can play the fucking bass. I'm going to teach you how. No problem.
And you said you were touring around with other bands previous to that.
I wasn't playing in the bands. I was, you know, selling merch.
Just touring with them. Okay, all right.
Yeah, I mean, this is like DIY hardcore in the early 90s. I was the dude with like the phone dialer and, you know, right. a few people's numbers and finding us places to stay. And
interpretive dance, that kind of
thing. Yeah, kind of have that like knack for logistics, have that nose for figuring out the fastest way between, you know, A and B right. and, you know, the cheapest way or whatever it may be. And so... it worked really well. The relationship in Good Clean Fun was great because, well, it was, I would say it was great in the sense that, you know, Issa was really, he was the creative and then I was more of the, you know, implementative, if that's even a word.
Is now.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, we toured all over the world for the better part of 4 or 5 years. Eventually I grew a little bit tired of it. We sort of went through the rotating cast of other members. You know, it's hard to stay in a band that tours 9 to 10 months out of the year and doesn't really make a lot of money. You know, we made it work for ourselves. And it's not to say we never made money. We just would reappropriate our funds, meaning we'd go to Europe and come, you know, we'd make okay money and then all of a sudden we get an offer to go to South America where we had to buy the tickets, but right. we wanted to go to South America.
Right.
So
right. Now is that, do you attribute some of that as to what you turned into? Like because you did the band for 4 to 5 years for 9 to 10 months out of the year, working as hard as you did, broke all the time. Was there something in you that logistical implementative side of you that said, there's gotta be a better way, dude, I can figure this out. Is that part of it?
A little bit. I mean, oddly enough, I sort of just followed the opportunities as they presented themselves. So, you know, I went from being in Good Clean Fun to tour managing. Mm. And I didn't even mean to start tour managing. I got the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I lived in California, I went to Europe in 1995 with Chokehold, the famous Canadian straight edge band,
yeah,
and toured all over there. And we did a few shows with Snapcase and Refused. And I became
Snapcase.
They were awesome. Highlight of that trip. Well, there's multiple highlights, but one of the many highlights of that trip was one of the shows we did in Holland. And we all, like, it was Chokehold, a Dutch band called Feeding the Fire, Snapcase and Refused. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us went down to like the little city that we were in, like the town center, and there was like a fair going on.
Okay.
And they had bumper cars. And I don't know if this is just like, you know, storytelling history, but it seemed as if their bumper cars were a little like better than our bumper cars. You know, I feel like in the US bumper cars have to go a certain speed only, and you know, everybody's so afraid of a lawsuit that, like,
sure, they've got like they've got governors on them at like 3 miles an hour or something.
Totally.
Right? Yeah. I don't even.
So we're like cruising, you know, and there's like 25 straight edge dudes, or you know, 24 of us are straight edge. We all roll in, and it just so happens that one round, and I'm going to continue to use that number. Let's say there's 30 cars out there, so 24 straight edge dudes. Okay. Are out there, and six like regulars, civilians, dudes from the town that are rolling in. And of course, one of them's wearing like a marijuana hat or something because we're in Holland.
Right on.
And literally somebody's like, straight edge revenge. And we just all start trying to mess that dude up. Just bam, bam.
Poor dude.
It's got no clue what hit him.
Probably
no
clue what's probably tokes once in a while, just wants to relax. And here comes Snapcase.
You know, lives in a place that it's totally legal.
Right. Right. Lives in Holland. Doing nothing wrong. Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. Out on a Saturday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon trying to have a good time.
Why are you all picking on me? Do you know ya?
Now, do they tell me now?
you know, we're all sitting there, you know, singing the lines to the Project X song. Nice. It was so good.
Hilarious. Poor guy.
So on that trip,
I hope he was high. That would have been a wild ride if he was like, that was the wildest bumper cars I've ever.
I hope he was too. And, you know, I can never go on bumper cars again without thinking about just trying to find the glaring non-edge dude and just go after him.
Straight edge revenge.
So on said trip, I met the Refused guys. Mm. And, you know, Dennis was a dude who, you know, stayed in touch with a lot of people, was pen pals with a lot of guys in the States. And, you know, more or less he was a scenester and I was an aspiring scenester. So we traded information. He and I wrote back and forth a bunch, became friends. And so when his band International Noise Conspiracy was first taking off and they needed to come to the States, they called a friend of ours, Jason Hammaker. Jason was the drummer in Frotis, drummer in Battery. And Jason had done so many of the logistics when Frotis and Refused toured, because they toured in the States and they toured in Europe. So he was kind of like the go-to guy. Unfortunately, Jason's fiance at the time was battling cancer.
Yeah.
And he,
I heard that when I talked to Shelby, that's a shame.
Yeah. And so he wasn't able to do it. And so he recommended to the band's manager, you should, you know, call Mike. You know, Dennis knows Mike. Call Mike to, I mean, they were coming over for 3 days. This was 99, I believe. 99 or 2000. One of the things that I'm not good at is remembering dates.
Okay.
Either 99 or 2000. Maybe it was more like 2000. Although, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Okay. Noise Conspiracy was coming over to do CMJ. And so their agent put together what I was told was like, hey, they're going to come over, play Boston, play DC, and do CMJ. Can you help out? Sure, I got a van. What else do you need? Oh, find some equipment. No problem. Blah, 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 blah. Next thing you know, it's a month-long tour. So
look at you.
I go from the dude with a van to being what's known as like a tour manager. And I was like, I was like, wait, isn't that the bass player? Because all the stuff you're describing is all the stuff that I was doing, you know, figuring out logistics, you know, all the stuff that I had been doing in Good Clean Fun.
Right.
And so this was like my first taste of, I guess, like industry proper. You know, everything else prior to that had been very DIY. Explicitly DIY, like more like intentionally DIY, I should say.
Right, right, right.
And so this was cool. I mean, the gig with Noise Conspiracy was a lot of fun because at the time they were all straight edge and they were all vegan. I was straight edge and I was vegan. And this is like early 2000s, pre, you know, smartphones, pre GPS.
Right, right.
It was like an adventure every day. Like we would try to, I'd figure out the way that we could get to town, go find like the good vegan restaurant, go to the show, play the show, bust out, and do it all again the next day in a different city, and potentially link up with, you know, people that Dennis may have known from his previous touring in Refused, or people I knew from all the Good Clean Fun days. And like the first few tours of Noise Conspiracy was just like a blast. Mm-hmm. It was like, it didn't feel like, I mean, I was working, you know, 18, 19, 20 hours a day.
Sure.
But it didn't feel like work because I was having such a good time. I felt like this host to these awesome Swedish people that were, you know, playing cool music with a great message.
It's not a punch out after 8 hour kind of a job either. You're with them. So
right.
The better you take care of them, the better you're going to eat.
Totally. And, right. You know, I mean, it was an interesting dynamic because Dennis was, you know, he was the oldest one other than, at the time, Sarah, who was she'd been in the Donuts and she was his girlfriend for a long time.
Right.
You know, Dennis was sort of like the leader and he and I were friends and the other guys, you know, I think the dynamic was just sort of set up like they were like looking to us to figure it out, you know, like how do we, and so that's what we did every single day, figured it out.
Was this a calling ahead for hotel kind of a tour, or was this a figure it out every night as you go tour?
It was a figure it out every night as you go ahead tour. Our strategy, because none of us were boozers, because mm-hmm. none of us drank and partying wasn't really even on the agenda.
Right.
We would just want to get out of town. Mm-hmm. So it was drive down the road 2 hours because, you know, it's midnight and we're not going to fall asleep until 2 anyways.
Right.
Drive down the road, get the Motel 8 or, you know, Super 8 or whatever it was, Best mm-hmm. Western. And yeah, I mean, there were some frustrating nights where, you know, you're rolling in thinking that there would be a room, you know, you're trying to get one or two rooms and there's some dude like, you can't have 8 people in those 2 rooms. And you're like, right. Oh, there's only 4. The others are sleeping in the van.
Right. So,
but it definitely, I mean, it worked with my skill set. Like mm-hmm. I'm a problem solver, you know, that's sort of what I do, which is, you know, inevitably what probably led me into wanting or, you know, doing the management thing next.
Right.
Solving problems.
Problem solver.
Yeah.
So how far, how long have you been married?
I have been married 5 years.
Okay.
So 5.5 years.
Marrying her wasn't occurring right around at this time. So there wasn't,
no.
I got to pay bills because I have somebody else thing yet. Right.
No, there wasn't that. And there still doesn't necessarily exist because my wife is a professional.
Very good. Sugar mama. Nice.
You know, yeah. Sugar mama.
Well done. Well played. So, when did Outer Loop become a reality?
So,
there's a gap of time here that I'm trying to fill.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I thought you told me you'd listened to all those other podcasts that covered all this stuff.
I did. That was also well played. Hang on, let me read the notebooks worth of notes that I took on you. Just answer the question, you dick.
Yeah, exactly. So I did that for a long time and Noise Conspiracy started to change. You know, the members in the band, their priorities changed. Certain of them started drinking. Mm-hmm. Certain of them started, you know, not being vegan any longer. And not that those were, it's more just those were the easily identifiable parts where things within the band changed. But really what had happened was, as far as I was concerned, I'd sort of done all I felt that I could do. And the goal of a good tour manager is really, maybe not the goal, but I was helping these guys achieve their goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their goal is to become a big band. And part of that strategy is touring. And I toured all over the world taking care of them. And the beautiful thing was, even once they started drinking, and I even started drinking at some point, like, none of us were wrecks. It wasn't like I was chasing dudes down at 4 a.m. Like, right. That was never going to be my gig. It's just not what I was interested in. But at some point, I decided that I wanted to maybe not get married just yet, but I kind of wanted to try to have, you know, maybe a more significant relationship. As a runner, a guy that, you know, likes to run as an athletic type person, I wanted to run some marathons. Mm-hmm. Or at least a marathon. And that's a really challenging thing to do. I mean, I definitely ran on the road. One of my favorite things, I mean, what's really interesting is, you know, the terrible events that happened in Paris the other week, you know, I was thinking about when I was touring and, you know, all of us that are involved in music that have ever been to a show probably had the like, oh shit, this could have been us. Could have been people that we know. You know, it's terrible for all the people that it happened to, but I think that's why you saw such a massive reaction within our community, you know, or just the music is like, holy shit.
Sure.
All of a sudden, you know, when you've got military operations going on in Afghanistan, unless, you know, your cousin who you're super close with or your brother is over there fighting, it's this weird, distant thing that,
yeah, I know.
It's hard to wrap your head around, you know?
It doesn't seem real. It's like, it's very, I'm sitting outside the aquarium watching it.
Completely.
Yeah.
And this was like the, oh crap.
Hit too close to home, right? I remember the Rhode Island Great White thing was, the first thing I thought was, how many clubs have I been in that were more unsafe than that one, where everyone around me was smoking? And it was like, man, that place could have went up at any time. And I was just standing there like, yeah, I was in unsafe shows all time.
Well, in that one, I mean, you're such a big Great White fan. I'm sure that, like, it had to have hit home because you could be at a Great White show any night of the week.
Once bitten, twice shy, baby.
But I was thinking about, you know, you saw so many people posting, you know, their almost personal take on it and guilty as charged. I did a very similar thing, and it got me thinking to Paris because France – you know, when I was touring with Noise Conspiracy, and even before that with Good Clean Fun, as a vegan, France is not really your friend. You know, it's like, here's couscous, you know, and here's bread. And we like to put this awesome thing called cheese on the bread, but you don't eat that.
We put cheese in everything. Yeah.
And then we drink this awesome beverage called wine, but you don't drink that.
Right.
So even if you weren't, you know, so France just, it was an awesome country to go to. I've been there a ton, but it was just this weird, you know, it was sort of a love-hate thing. But one of the things that I really did love was when I would go running around Paris. I mean, I live just outside of D.C. now, but when I used to live down in D.C., training for marathons, I'd go on these really cool long runs all around the monuments.
Yeah.
And
wow.
When it's in your backyard, you're sort of like, oh, cool. You know, here's the monuments. Like, but at some point, I was like, you know, in Paris running around, I'm like, all right, I'm running past the Louvre. I'm running past Arc de Triomphe. I'm running past Obelisk. I'm running past all these awesome places.
It must have been amazing.
It was amazing. And so the way that it all sort of ties together here is like, I was able to go do these runs, but if you're going to run a marathon, you got to train, you know, at least once a week, you got to run like, you know, a significant number of miles.
Yep.
Noise Conspiracy has, well as they did, they're not a massive, you know, band that's 3 days on, one day off in a, you know, super nice Ritz-Carlton. It was a grind. You know, we were out there, we were doing it. And if we were staying in a hotel, it was like a Formula One, which is like a budget version of a Motel 6 in Europe.
Okay.
Or we were just doing 7 days a week. And so my point is, at some point, my life wasn't, I wasn't in control of my own like life. Essentially, my schedule was dictated by what I had to do for the band.
Of course. Sure.
So that combined, you know, yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
And again, I didn't really want to go work for somebody else. I didn't want to be, I watched a lot of people who I met out there, tour managers who were getting older, and not everybody who's an older tour manager is like this, but a lot of bitter, bitter people that just were like, F this, F the road, F these people, da 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 da. And I was just like, that's not what I want to be in life. So I got the opportunity, good friend of mine, Mike Schleibaum, guitar player for the band Darkest Hour, also played in Battery. Darkest Hour got offered Ozfest tour 2004, as part of their deal with the
I've heard of it.
As part of their deal with the Great Victory Records, and they sort of said, "Oh, you know, what are we? How do we do this? You know?" And this was 2004 is really like in my mind the year that the industry, you know, a lot of bands that were hardcore or metal hardcore or punk influenced metal hardcore all of a sudden needed a manager. But a manager was like this bad man who came in and took your money and did nothing. So they turned to resourceful people.
Why? Why 2004? Like,
I think it's just because the metalcore explosion. Hmm. And I think the metalcore explosion
Shadows
came
Fall.
From Shadows Fall, Killswitch, yeah. Bleeding Through, yep. Throwdown, Darkest yep. Hour, all these guys who grew up essentially punk, straight edge, hardcore, whatever, started to cross over, and they wanted to trust the person who was in charge of their career.
Okay.
So look at Bleeding Through and Throwdown. They chose a dude like Ryan Downey. You know, yep. That's how we got introduced, was Downey. Look at Darkest Hour, they chose, and Misery Signals, and those type of guys who came out of that scene, they chose a Mike Mowry. You know, look at any of those other number of people, and they chose somebody who was familiar to them,
who they knew wasn't just going to quote unquote take their money.
Right.
And so that gave me the start to managing. And here we are almost 12 years later. And
so Outer Loop was kind of kicked into gear by Darkest Hour coming to you and saying, we got Ozfest. What do we do?
Yeah. And Mike, because we were in DC.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Sure.
Ignorant. I'm not in the industry question. How does Darkest Hour get Ozfest without a manager?
Victory Records. Okay. So Ozfest Second Stage used to require a very significant marketing commitment.
Okay.
Because they were going to take the marketing dollars that all the labels contributed and use it to advertise. And so for some of these younger bands on these smaller labels, more independent labels, it was a great opportunity. And if you look back through the history, some of them, it really worked and some of those bands took off. Others, you know, it didn't necessarily, but it was a pretty good bet. So they were trying to figure out you had to deal. So the marketing commitment came from the label, and then all the logistics you sort of had to figure out with the label or, you know, on your own.
And enter the need for a manager that you can trust.
Precisely. Okay. And so really what they probably needed more than anything was a great tour manager, right? I mean, that could have been it, but in some senses, they did need a manager. I mean, as their career was growing, they did need somebody who could look after them and guide them. Interesting, you know, with Darkest Hour, they were on Victory, and Tony Brummel, the owner of Victory, you know, despises managers. He doesn't want to deal with managers. He hates dealing with them.
Well,
oftentimes refusing to deal with them, you know, for his self-serving purposes.
Sure. We've all
very.
that's all been talked about before.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So we're in DC. Mike Schleibaum says, Hey, we're in DC. There's not a ton of music people here. Our attorney's based here. You should meet him. So I met their attorney and had a conversation, and he indicated that, you know, he had done a bunch of record deals for bands. And so what happens, especially back then, even now, I mean, this is what I do. If I get a band that I'm trying to get signed, you know, I'm dealing with the label. I'm pitching it to the A&R. I'm trying to see who's interested. But when it comes time to look over the paperwork, I go and find an attorney. And so if I'm not a manager and I'm just a band out there, that should be my step. My step should be I go find an attorney, and you want an attorney who's going to, you know, advise you on what points in the deal are good versus bad, negotiate for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so this attorney, band's attorney, had done a bunch of those deals for a number of artists, and the artists were then turning to him and saying, well, what do we do now? You know, how do we get the tours? How does all this work? And so we thought that, you know, our two, you know, separate circles within the industry and what we do would overlap very well. And he knew another manager from the local DC Baltimore area, and the three of us started the company.
Got it. Okay. What would the difference between Outer Loop Management and Outer Loop Records be? Is that just, I mean, again, outsider looking in, that just looks to me like next level of, like, instead of getting a record label involved, I'll be the label too.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because as the DIY, like, punk that is still just sits within my core, no matter how far removed I am from that, you know, it surely shaped how I view business.
There's still that angry kid in the bumper car at once.
Yeah. That was the snap case, guys, but I don't think they're as angry anymore. There might be a lot of angry fans who saw them play at This Is Hardcore, but
Philly.
because they left out a few of the gems, I'm told.
Sure. Yeah, that's what I've heard. That
yeah, they played a band set instead of a fan set.
Right. Well,
what's hilarious is I've refused to play a big festival up in Quebec, Montebello, Quebec, this summer, and I flew in to see it. There's a lot of other great artists playing, and Refuse played the second stage, and Snapcase, played later on a smaller stage. Mm-hmm. So we went over to watch them, and as they're playing, I had to nudge one of the guys in Refuse and say, "See, no matter what you do with your career, you will always play before Snapcase."
Nice, but
yeah. I've always got a one-liner somewhere. It's not always tasteful, and it doesn't always propel me forward. But
that's all right. We're not here for taste.
When I got into management, I mean, 2004, the record industry was supposedly dying, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's when it started to go downhill. So the idea of starting a record label just didn't make any sense, and because it was not going to be a good business venture.
Sure.
Right. So I started managing artists, and lo and behold, you know, friends of mine who started labels even later than 2004, some of them have done very well by themselves, but I wanted to look out for the artist. I mean, that's sort of what the DIY punk within me wanted to do. And eventually, the goal of the record label is still to help artists.
Okay.
And there's an artist, Ice Nine Kills, who I became friends with them. They came through. We used to help operate a club down in the DC area. And every time they came through, you know, they were just really great guys, played incredibly well. I couldn't figure out why they weren't more popular. Mm. So I started digging in a little bit. And I was having conversations with the singer, who was just a really smart, funny, charismatic, witty guy. And we sort of hit it off, and I was like, man, you know, I want to help these guys. So I started digging in. They're on a label that is treating them completely unfairly.
Who's that?
And, well, I didn't sign the separation agreement with them, so I can say it's called Red Blue Records.
Okay.
Small label out of, I think, the Boston area. Okay. And the owner's, like, kind of notorious. He started some clothing company as well, and, like, went out on Warped Tour and got kicked off of Warped for, like, soliciting underage girls or something, you know, just
whoa.
Dude's not really of the character that I like to associate myself with. Right. And I actually have never met him, but have dealt with him. But knowing what I knew about the industry, I said to the band, I was like, you just can't do another record with this guy. Like, you know, you've got the talent where if we can get you in the cool club, if we can get other people to validate you, this can work.
Mm.
And so the way I sort of view, especially like the Warped Tour world and the developing artist world, you got to get these multiple sources of validation. You got to get the right manager and or the right agent and or the right label.
Okay.
You know, sometimes you can get away with having none of those. Those are the big exceptions to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
You can surely have the right label and do all right. Or if you get two of those three, you're probably in good shape. But if you get all three, your chances of success, especially if you're a good band, are much, much greater.
Sure.
So I felt as if I was going to validate them. I would take them under my wing. But I felt like so much damage had been done. And the band had done a little bit of damage themselves. Boys will be boys. I mean, young guys in bands do stupid shit. They say the wrong things to the wrong people. I mean, if you could dig up archives of the dumb shit that I did, you know, when I was a stupid hardcore kid, mm-hmm. like, you know,
like what
I like drive around in a bumper car and crash up, you know, cannabis loving dudes in Holland. How's that?
That's it. That's the worst thing you've ever done.
That's the worst.
I feel like your time's almost up because they don't let you talk very long in jail while you're on a podcast. Such a badass.
Yeah, exactly. What's up? No, but I mean, all of us. I mean, we just would do stupid What's shit, up? Like talk shit.
I need stories, dude. The word story is in the title of the podcast. Go ahead, let it rip.
I'm trying to think where the stories are. I'm the guy that told you I can't even remember dates, let alone
take your time. Take your time. I got all day. You know, obviously,
we'll have to come back to that. Yeah.
Okay. I'll edit it and move it back in. Yeah.
Completely. But so the long of the story of this part of it is the band Ice Nine Kills. I convinced them. We worked out a deal with the label. Mm-hmm. The band invested in themselves by buying themselves out of the label deal. Totally sucked. I mean, the dude had never accounted to that. All this stuff that should have, and I find this a lot in like business, especially in the business that like I'm in. A lot of people are like very short-sighted. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, he owes us this. Da, 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 da. It's like, he's not going to give that to you. So right. Yes, it sucks. Yes, it's unfair. But if you'll just spend $1, $5, $10, $100, $1,000, in this case, you know, a relatively significant amount of money for a small band to get yourself out of there, that's the one chance you have. Mm. And thankfully, this band figured out how to do it. So we then crowdfunded an EP for them. I knew they had a really small, dedicated fan base, and I knew we could turn to them to sort of build that story.
You have kind of a good track record with crowdfunding stuff too, right?
I do have a pretty good record with crowdfunding. I think we're almost batting 1,000 on that.
Well played. Okay.
But I feel it's because we've done a lot of the homework on it. Like mm-hmm. we know if a band has a dedicated fan base in order to tap in, but it's never a sure thing. Like there's always a small sense of doubt. Mm-hmm. So there's always a small sense, you know, I mean, there's like, hey, it's a little bit of a risk, which is
sure.
But got these guys to do that. And then part of that was you go back to validation. Okay. If the industry isn't going to validate them, will the fans validate them? And therefore will the industry validate? And so I took it around to all of my friends at labels and still nobody wanted anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I had been kicking around the idea of starting a label for a number of reasons. But really, that was it. That was the impetus. It was the final straw that broke the camel's back because I was afraid of starting a label and being a manager and like having the two overlap mm-hmm. and somehow having conflicts of interest. And it was, again, going back to those punk DIY roots, like that's not what I want. You know, I don't want to have conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. I want the bands to be looked after and to be treated very fairly. But at this stage, I was like, look, here's this band. I can't get anybody else to do it. A couple of other things, you know, I was developing other artists, signing them off to certain labels and then having to go like beg those labels for the money to do the stuff that I was implementing. Mm-hmm. So all of the ingredients finally came together mm-hmm. and decided to go and start a label. And so we went around. I'm a manager. I didn't want to go start a label and have to run a label all day long. So there's a lot of people out there that do great work with labels.
Right.
And so we went and talked to a few of those and ended up partnering with Fearless Records. So they're our partner. That's how we actually release our records. We use their system, which is great because I felt like I was able to look out for the artists in the way that I wanted because I wasn't limiting them by them signing to my label. Mm-hmm. I was actually helping them and going to this staff that's just such an incredible staff working these bands and these records the way that they should be worked anyways.
Right.
So thus far, it's really been a especially for Ice Nine Kills, it's been an incredibly positive experience.
Very good. Very good. I don't even know if it's worth going down a logistical hole or not, but I guess what would the major difference be between someone who's signed to Outer Loop who works with Fearless versus a band that signs with Fearless? Why not just sign with Fearless?
Part of it is who brings it in, right? Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. If I identify the talent or, you know, my office, when I say I really mean Outer Loop.
There's a number of people that
work there and support me. I couldn't do any of the stuff that I do without the team that I have. But if we bring it in, and we get into this sometimes because bands, they want to be signed to Fearless. Fearless has the reputation. Fearless has the, you know, mechanism. But my sell to the band is you get Fearless and me. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you like me and like the work that I do, why wouldn't you want me as your advocate alongside Fearless?
Sure.
Now, you know, there could be the argument made. I mean, I'm based in Washington, D.C. Fearless is based in L.A., California. You know, when I'm not there in their faces talking up my bands all the time, maybe they're not getting the same attention that they would otherwise. But I think what you inevitably see at almost every label is, you know, there's a period of really believing, caring, loving, wanting the band to do well. And then if that starts to take off, mm-hmm. no matter who's on the team is paying attention to it.
Sure.
And so that happened with a band like Ice Nine Kills, you know, I had pitched them the Fearless, you know, and this is no dig on Fearless because no other record label wanted to sign the band either. And frankly, I understood their concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find as a manager, and I didn't really realize this until I had the label, and then other managers started pitching me. So what happens is if you're a manager, it's sort of like you said you have a kid.
I have three kids.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you got three kids. Mm-hmm. Think about if your neighbor from across the street comes over and says, "Hey, Travis, I know you run this baseball team. My kid is like going to be the star."
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, "Sure, dude. Great. You know, cool. Like, I'm sure he will too." But if you watch your own kid play baseball on a daily basis and you know the ins and outs, and when you're on vacation, you guys are throwing the ball on the beach and, you know, you see that the kid's got, you know, him or her, you know, has a fastball that you can't believe. Like, you have that intimate knowledge of their skill set and their being, like their personality, like all the things that you want in a band. That's what a manager does. A manager gets in on that level.
Mm-hmm.
If you run a label and somebody, another manager who has all of those relationships with the artist comes to you and says, "Hey, here's this band that has all this." You kind of look at them and say, you know, okay, cool. Like, yeah, maybe they do.
Good for them.
But you're not sure.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
You're not sure. And you've got 20 other people coming and saying the exact same thing. And so.
That's funny. Record labels are suffering from the same thing that we are as Bandcamp listeners, where you have 15 seconds to impress me. And
Yeah. No, you're exactly right.
Whereas if my buddy Mike or Downey says, "Trav, I know you. You will love this band. You need to check this out because I know you like this and I know you hate when bands do this," and ding, 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 and they go right down the list and it comes recommended from a friend, I'm going to give them more than the intro of track one. You know what I mean?
No, you're exactly right.
Okay.
And so that's a huge part that, you know, and old school when there was more time and more resources, and not to say that certain A&R people don't still do this, like, that's what a good A&R person does, is they take the time to get to know the band, you know, so they can feel that same, you know, passion that potentially the band feels.
Right on.
So that was, yeah.
You're slowing. Yeah, I lost you again.
All right.
Say the last part again about AR.
I was just going to say about A&R, you know, I mean, that's the difference now with A&R, and there are still certain great A&R people that have the ability and resources and time and energy and money to do this, but they go and they get to know the artist.
Right.
It is about the music. Don't get me wrong. A great A&R person has a great ear, and they go in and they, you know, they listen for that song, but so much of it is getting to know the person. Like, can the people in the band, can this front man, he might not have the song today, but will he have the song in 5 years? And does he have the charisma? He or she have the charisma, the personality, the drive. It's having those conversations that let you know, okay, when the bus breaks down in Boise, Idaho, and I don't mean the bus, I mean the van, and it's time, the shit hits the fan,
right?
Somebody's got to go get a U-Haul. Is the singer in and loves this and is passionate about it, or is he or she out? And that's what a good A&R of talent determines. They determine all of that stuff.
Gotcha.
And well, so that's good. Where, yeah, and, well, thanks. I mean, and that's where we as managers of developing artists, I get to spend a lot of time, but it sometimes backfires because you want the people to succeed so badly. You become so attached to them, and you become so, you know, you just want them to succeed.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't see there's no chance that this is going to work. You know, everybody else sees it. And that's where we were with that band, Ice Nine Kills. Like, a lot of other people didn't think it was going to work. I was willing to take a risk. We could easily be having this conversation and it wouldn't have worked out. I'm not Flostradamus or whatever the great predictor of future future bands that can sell 100 tickets in Albany, New York is.
Flostradamus. I think I've talked to a lot of people that said somewhere along the lines of, like, as things started to gallop and start to require a little bit more, it's a shame. At that time, I didn't know I couldn't trust my bandmates. I couldn't trust the AR guy or girl. I couldn't trust management because, as soon as it starts hitting the fan, this is too much. I'm out of here. What do you mean you're out of here? The three of us are just supposed to stay here and find the new bass player, find the new drummer. Like,
I mean, you know, I take great pride in being there for the ups and the downs. Mm-hmm. You know, if I commit to something, I'm committed. And if your band is on the, you know, believe me, I've eaten a fucking huge dose of humble pie, because there are times when artists are here when I'm there for the hard parts, but when the shit gets going good, the grass is greener somewhere else.
They fly. Sure.
And I end up getting burned, or what I feel is getting burned, because I've put in all this energy, work, and effort, and inevitably, you know, time will tell what happens when things get hard.
Sure.
If the new new manager is willing to stick it out and willing to put in, you know, that sort of same hard work and dedication.
I don't want you to name names. I know that would be uncomfortable, but from those situations that you've seen so far, have there been more of the, I guess they were better off, the grass was actually greener, or are there more situations of you going, dude, see, I told you?
I think the verdict's still out. I mean, that's a hard one to judge, in all honesty. And look, the one thing that I've learned a lot from, and I continue to just learn by experience, is, you know, patience. I have to think back to when I was 22, 23, 24, 25. And though I wasn't.
Can you remember back that far?
Exactly. I wrote lengthy journals, thankfully.
Good move.
Yeah. And I'm really happy that the internet didn't really exist then.
Oh boy. Right.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, it's tough because you want success and you want to think about how to get there and get there as fast as you can.
Sure.
And if there's somebody else who can potentially get you there quicker, why not?
Sure.
you know, and then as you get older and you realize that, okay, not everything is an upward trajectory, and you take some big steps backward and you take some huge fumbles backward, who's there for you when, you know, you get knocked down? And that's how you find out who your friends are.
Yeah, man.
You know, that's how you find out who in your family you can count on. And inevitably in business, it's sort of the same thing.
Sure. Man, you're hitting close to home with the friends and the family stuff because, yeah, go through – Let's squirt out the other side of a tragedy and see who's hanging out. See who still wants to text me, you know?
No, completely. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and believe me, I've been through some terrible tragedy myself. And you also realize that, like, some people want to help, but they're dealing with their own stuff.
Sure.
And don't know how to help.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you start to look and say, oh, how could I be of more assistance to that person? Man, they really let me down, or man, they weren't there for me in the way that I thought that they would be.
Right.
But is there a reason for that? You know, Is it because they didn't want to, or is it because they didn't have the ability, the skill set, the life experience, the whatever else to actually be able to do it?
Talked about Good Clean Fun, Out of Loop Management, Out of Loop Records. I don't care about Warped Tour. I want to talk about Crime Kitchen a little.
Uh-huh.
And I definitely want to talk about Jabberjaw. I have questions about Jabberjaw.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Let's see if they're fit for public consumption.
Well, no, it's nothing like that.
The Jabberjaw stuff has been interesting, and we can either get into this again or not. But
do it right now. Yeah, you just started Jabberjaw Media, which looks like most of the podcasts I was already listening to. You guys all decided to join forces and form this giant robot with, you know, what's the deal? What's Jabberjaw? Tell me all about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a podcast network. And so I got introduced – well – there was a couple other people potentially trying to do something similar a year and a half ago. And for whatever reason, that didn't work out. But when I went and did a bunch of podcasts in March, April, May of last year, one of those was the Bad Christian podcast.
Sure.
And I've known Matt Carter, one of the hosts of Bad Christian and a guitar player from Emory for a long time. Scott, one of the guys in my office, actually used to manage Emory. So we're relatively tight. It was nice to get reacquainted. You know, Matt on the podcast with me talks about management and sort of, you know, going back to the conversation that we had earlier, you know, managers that he doesn't feel have done enough to warrant the percentage that they charge.
Sure.
And so it was a relatively interesting conversation, but then I realized that they were trying to, you know, figure out a way for other podcasters that they had been sort of sharing. I don't know if it's, you know, just industry tidbits with, like, okay, you do this, you do that in terms of, you know, technicalities or, you know, how they're monetizing or whatever it may be. I don't know because I wasn't involved in those conversations, but
okay.
Once I heard that they were doing it, it really piqued my interest. I, you know, I really got into podcasting about a year ago. You know, Serial had come out, and I kept seeing everybody and their brother talking about Serial. And I'd listened to a few podcasts before. I'd listened to friends had been interviewed on, you know, like Dennis from Refuse and Invasion, and we managed both those bands, had been on Ray Harkin's podcast, so I'd like listened to that episode. But
I love Ray's podcast.
Yeah, he's awesome. Mm-hmm. I hadn't figured out like how to really – it probably felt like most people trying to find new music nowadays. Like, holy crap. There's a million inputs. Yeah. And how do I figure out what's good, what's bad? And you look at the timestamps on these things, and they're like an hour or an hour and a half. And like, who has an hour and an hour and a half?
Yeah.
You know, just like, where do I start? Mm-hmm. And so as a really busy guy, you know, who's working a lot, I just never had the free time to start to navigate those waters.
Right.
Until the break, which typically happens in the music business, you know, the at least the week in between Christmas and New Year's, oftentimes there's a little bit of, you know, we end up with about 2 weeks where as a manager, you're never really off, but you're really not in the day-to-day hustle and
you're
the
slow
grind. Yeah. Right. You're relatively slow.
Sure.
And so on the back of really enjoying Serial, and I enjoyed it a lot because one of the guys who I do business, I do producer management with, he and I were listening to it at the same time. And he was also sort of telling me about the music podcast that he liked. And I was exploring music podcasts. So over that break, you know, I started finding out about Bad Christian. I started finding out about, you know, some of these other podcasts and really became a fan of the format. I like it because just like this conversation, there's like no filter.
There's nowhere to hide. That's what I like.
There's nowhere to hide. Everybody's out there and we're talking about shit that like, okay, maybe, you know, in this case, I'm comfortable, you know, I mean, I own my own brand, if you will. But like if one of the guys who works for me was off running his mouth or her mouth, or a band member was off running his mouth or her mouth, like sometimes you want to have that editorial approval. And the podcast doesn't really give that. It's like, okay, it floats out in this space that nobody's really paying attention to anyway. So say whatever the fuck you want. And that's one of the reasons I really like Jamie Josta's podcast. I don't know if you listen to that one.
I do. I have my opinions about that.
A lot of people do. I like it. And one of the things that I really like about it and think of a reason why it's relevant for artists, and I think you'll find more artists creating their own podcast or things like this, is even though he uses it as a way to get his own information out, you know, which is, I think, what some people think the distaste is. It's like, it's a hate breed commercial. And it's like, I'm okay with that. You know,
that's not what bothers me. The first 7 or 8 minutes of it is what he's doing. And Jost is on tour and all that and everything. That's fine. But honestly, if we're going to roll our sleeves up, one episode he's talking to a lady from a band, you know, this is what we need is women to stop being objectified and hardcore and everything.
Yeah.
And then the next episode he's trying to get Steak and Titties Day approved, and I'm like,
all right,
pick a lane, partner. You know,
I'm with you on that. I fully can understand why and do agree with that. What I like about it, and part of it might just be a little bit voyeuristic, is he is getting these like stories out of people because he has the access to them.
Sure.
And I like, yeah, I mean, I guess 20 years ago, I probably would have not liked it for the same reason that even though Hatebreed played at the house that I lived in and Jamie and I were friends, I didn't really like Hatebreed because they were just a bunch of fucking bruisers that rolled through town and wanted to, you know, they want to fuck shit up.
Basketball jersey core.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, like, I get it. In some sense, it's entertainment, and he's great at it.
He is good, and his guests, I mean, I'll take the guests to turn him down.
And what's funny, you know, this is one thing I'll say. I mean, for the podcasts that I like, who continually get, like, pretty good guests, there's certain days that I'll wake up or, you know, I'll listen to these things on my run, or I listen to them, like, when I can't sleep. And there's times that like I don't know the guests, so I don't want to listen to them.
Right.
But inevitably, there's always something. And, you know, either as a fan or as a guy who is now involved in a podcast network, that I take away from it.
Yeah.
I'm like, ah, okay. You know, that helps me. That helps me. That helps me. So anyways, I became a big fan of the format.
Mm-hmm.
And as a fan of the format, when I found out these guys were starting the network, I wanted to figure out how I could get involved. I mean, one of the things that I do, and this is just because I've been around a long time and I've been involved with a number of things, is I have access, you know, and the way that, you know, you look up on your whiteboard and you're like, man, this guy's got seven different companies that he's involved with, but they all overlap and they all intertwine. I mean, you heard me say, okay, management and the record label, it's almost one and the same. I mean,
sure.
For the most part, I'm managing the bands that are on the label. That's not 100% the case, but at the end of the day, it's having the same conversations with people. And so for the podcasters, I was like, look, guys, you know, you're going to need, you know, this is how I think I can help. I can, you know, bring in certain shows or bring in certain guests as we go, or align us with certain business people, you name it. And we struck up a conversation. Thankfully, there was already some mutual, you know, like we'd done some business in the past, in the case of Matt Carter, Nick Bunda, who's the other partner involved, is his producer, for Bad Christian and Break It Down.
Right.
I actually didn't know Nick at the time, but he and I really have, you know, we've gotten along really well and we're playing on one another's strengths to try to build this network. I mean, okay. It's really in its infancy. The goal is to bring like-minded shows together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now, and you know, this could change over time, we're like music related, i.e. the host is either a musician or has been a musician,
mm-hmm.
and interviews musicians, or the people, you know, the hosts themselves who aren't musicians interview, you know, other musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So music is really the, you know,
the spinal cord.
The spinal cord. Thank you.
Gotcha.
And yeah, I mean, we're trying to aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to produce. We've produced two shows, and Shane Told from Silverstein, he has a show called Lead Singer Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Christian, the singer of Anne Berlin, he has one called The Art Collective. So those are shows that we've produced.
His is the one that's going to be something about how literature ties in with the art of the music, or something along that lines.
I played the fifth. I think you're correct.
It sounds really interesting to me, actually.
Yeah, I mean, and what is interesting to us is to really watch, and, you know, Metal Sucks is one that I went and, you know, made the pitch because I'm a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Metal Brainiac. Metal Brainiac's a really small podcast,
mm-hmm.
but I like it because it's done not in this fashion that we're doing, in the fashion that we already discussed, where mm-hmm. it's just, you know, basically diarrhea of the mouth. We're, you know, talking about our long history.
Right.
And there's no editing or whatever. But what Metal Brainiac does is he goes in, he's a journalist. He's been a journalist in the past. He's worked for, you know, newspapers and television shows.
Okay.
And he goes in with sort of that more NPR, you know, This American Life, Gimlet style approach,
uh-huh.
of, you know, an interview that's cut up by the story that he's trying to tell.
Right.
So I really like it. I'm a fan of his show because of the way that he approaches it.
Mm-hmm.
And so our goal is, cool, let us come in and hopefully help bolster your numbers. Just as
right.
if you're an independent band recording in your studio that's there in your basement, you know, and you can release it online no problem tomorrow. But
yep.
might you, if you get hooked up with Outer Loop Records or, you know, any of these other people with a little bit more reach, might your numbers be able to be boosted? And so that's
right.
what we're trying to do.
Sure.
We're trying to take that artist friendly approach. You know, it's like, let's help each other. You know, in the case of the existing shows, they've got a listenership that hopefully we can, you know, A, grow, but B, introduce to the other podcasts within the network.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we can monetize it, not only for our benefit, but of course for the shows and the host benefit,
mm-hmm.
and then produce. Ultimately, we want to produce. We want to be people that make great shows.
Right.
So now, it's really freaking exciting.
You said it's in its infancy. You just sent out the first media release like 2 weeks ago. It's really in its infancy.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it was like a mad dash to the finish line to get everything done. I mean, we initially wanted to announce in August and then it was September. And, you know, part of it is this is each one of us. It's like our third job.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, I thankfully have, again, as I said earlier, you know, and I'm fortunate in this case that I'm able to do this. I don't have a lot of other restraints on me in the sense of family obligations or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. If I say I'm going to work on something, I find the time to work on it. Mm-hmm. And in the case of something that excites me, which this does, it's easy to find that effort. And I have a fantastic couple of people in my office that I can lean on that really help, you know, do a ton of this stuff, as does Matt from Bad Christian, you know, as does Nick from, you know, who's the producer. Like, we all are able to tie our resources together and hopefully build something, you know, where the sum is bigger than the, you know, the parts.
Why does Bad Christian need a media outlet? They seem to be, I mean, down looking up, they seem to be doing fine.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, why does a major label artist still need a label?
Sure.
I mean, that's the age old question. I mean, a little bit of this is Matt Carter, who is a, you know, he's a host of Bad Christian. He's involved.
Right.
So, you know, because it's his idea, makes it way easier for us to bring them in. I mean, he wants to, and again, you know, there's some behind closed doors things where, you know, believe me, they're being benefited all of the work that they've done. And that's what, to me, what's so exciting is I could have easily said, wow, I love podcasts. Let me call up Metal Sucks, Metal Brainiac, Washed Up Emo, Modern Vinyl, and Matt Pryor and Shane from Silverstein and form a podcast network.
Right.
But you tried to get me on the phone, you know, to do a podcast for 2 hours. Like, that's not where my strengths lie.
Gotcha.
These guys have, I mean, Bad Christian has learned so much in their 2 years.
Of course. Yeah.
That we want to be able to take their knowledge along with some of our connections and
that's kind of where I was steering it. It looks to me like if you pass a strip mall, someone's building a strip mall, the anchor store is L.L. Bean or Target or Lowe's or something big that we can live on different sides of the country in different time zones and we all know what that store is.
Yep.
And then there's also the little shops that are still for rent. Don't worry about it. They're going to want the space because it's connected to Target.
Yeah.
You know, and they look to me like Bad Christian. I you know, and looking at the media release that you put out, they were the one that you that Jabberjaw, all Jabberjaw, kind of specifically went down and did some numbers and everything. And it looked to me like, well, Bad Christian's just obviously the anchor store of this thing, and that's the name that made people go, oh, as opposed to Jabberjaw Media has 4 podcasts on it, and you maybe heard of 2 of them, and there's these 2 little ones that we really believe in. Yeah, more noise, blah 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 blah, another, you know, another buzz on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ray's show has a pretty good following, and definitely, Ray has, you know, 100 words or less. So that was a, you know, and Ray was initially part of, you know, the people putting the network together. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't able to come in as, you know, one of the founding members for reasons that, you know, aren't really free for me to discuss. Nothing bad, actually something good for him. But basically his time, he wasn't going to be able to commit in the way that we all felt that, you know, he needed to. But, you know, we know for a fact, just as we thought, Shane from Silverstein, again, we talk about Jamie from Hatebreed's podcast, right? Uh-huh. I mean, sure, he was the host of Headbangers, but he's a frontman for a big fucking band.
Yes, like, he is.
Silverstein is not as big as Hatebreed, but they're not a small band.
True.
And so, and one of the things, and Matt Carter said this to me very early on when, you know, because I got into it because I like the format, and I have identified people in my mind who I want to be hosts of future podcasts. Mm-hmm. But he said to me is, how are they going to be different? What lane about them is going to be unique?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a million people just like yourself. Don't take this the wrong way that are getting a bunch of people on there to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What differentiates it? Why is As the Story Grows different than all of these other shows that get on a bunch of Mike Mowry's who can talk all day long
mm-hmm.
and tell their story? Because as you even said, Mowry, you've been on like five other podcasts. What's going to make this one different?
Sure.
And so like you take Shane from Silverstein, his is lead singer syndrome. He's talking to lead singers about what it's like to be a lead singer.
Mm-hmm.
The challenges, the benefits, you know, all of the things that go into that. And so to us, that's unique. Plus he's got he's already got the name. Stephen Christian, as you said, from Anne Boleyn with the Art Collective, talking about how literature and art and everything fit into music. It's different. Bad Christian. I mean, that's the flagship there is you take guys that are in bands, they're getting musicians on occasionally, but they're talking about their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, how their faith is different than most people would want them to act
right.
as members of, you know, the church.
Right.
It's different. And so that to me, when, you know, Matt Carter is a very, very, very smart guy. He's, you know, and when he said that, a little light bulb went off, like, you're exactly right. So how can each person that I think has a history, been in a band, yada, yada, how are they going to do something different? Because eventually everyone's going to have a podcast.
Yeah.
And we're all just going to be interviewing each other.
Sure.
So what makes me bringing you on my podcast in a year, how's it going to be different than this exact same thing other than you're telling your story?
Sure.
Well, it's right, going to be because I ask you about, you know, your deformed genitalia.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know how you found out about that. I thought I took all the pictures down. Internet is forever, man.
I thought I could get you there. You're just like, mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
I'm unflappable, Mowry. Hey, can yeah. I ask, you made me think of a question. Can I ask, I think I want to get into something with you.
Sure, why not?
What causes a straight edge vegan kid to start drinking?
Man. I think all of us that were straight edge and vegan have our own reasons. So I didn't really touch on this, but at one point when I was tour managing Noise Conspiracy, I talked about wanting to get out and, you know, starting to run and do all of that stuff. And I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do. I was living in a friend's basement, a relatively nice basement in DC, and I was kind of scouring the want ads. And one day I saw a job advertisement for like an outdoor education specialist. And so my degree was environmental studies back in Santa Barbara.
Cool.
And I love hiking. I love camping. I love all this stuff. I was like, okay, this is at least sounds interesting. Let me give it a call.
I'm going to try to go to college for camping.
Yeah, exactly.
Good shot.
So I end up doing this apprenticeship at an outdoor education company based in the Washington, D.C. area. Their main core of business is like running ropes courses. And that was sort of exciting, but they also had stuff where they would take, you know, predominantly like junior high to high school age kids out on adventures. Sometimes they'd be overnight camping trips. Sometimes they'd just be canoeing or kayaking or rock climbing or whatever. Okay. And so this was like my first foray into the civilian world. It's not actually true, but like the end of their days, you know, when we're outside all day long, you meet at the whatever at 8 o'clock and you're done at 5:30, like they would all go to a bar. And I was like, wow, this is kind of weird. I don't ever go to bars. Mm-hmm. You know, the only time I'm in a bar is there's a show. And like, I don't know, at some point I was just like, wow, these people seem to be enjoying their lives a lot. And I don't, you know, like, what am I missing out on? And so it just started very innocently, like, let's have a beer. And now I've got a massive heroin problem.
Wow.
That's the
exclusive. How long did it take?
About an hour.
Later that night.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I get my first hops to come? And an hour and a half later, you're looking for a spoon.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got it.
But, you know, I mean, it was just, it was, it,
it felt like the right time. It felt like the right place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to be a sloppy idiot to enjoy alcohol.
Well, totally. And like, you know, the thing about the punk rock world is, and again, not everybody is like this, but when you're, you know, when you're straight edge, you kind of don't notice the dudes that are drinking who aren't sloppy, right? Because most of them end up really sloppy because we're hanging out at shows and bars till 4 a.m.
Sure.
And when you drink, myself included, when I start drinking at 8 p.m. and I end up at closing the bar at 4 a.m, you've had enough drinks to really like
to be sloppy.
Yeah.
You qualify.
And so
sure.
The guy that went home at 10 o'clock that had had two beers, like you don't see him, you don't pay attention to him. That's like me. You're like, nah, was he there? Nah, yeah. He left so long ago that I'm not even sure if he was there.
Right.
So when you hang out with people at a happy hour or whatever it is in the normal context of most people's lives, and you go to the bar for a beer and then you leave, you're like, oh, wow, yeah, people actually like just drink and it's a social thing and they enjoy it. And
I've gotten that a lot where yeah. someone will see me have a beer and then they'll see me have a beer and then they'll see me have a bottle of water.
Yeah.
Pussy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, actually, see, alcohol is a dehydrant and it's pulling water out of your system. And it's technically a poison. It's slowing the synapses in your brain. And the reason that it does that is because it's actually dehydrating your body. So not only am I smarter than you, and if there's problems here tonight, I'm going to get out of it quicker than you. But tomorrow I'm not going to be sick and I'm not going to have a headache. So would you like a bottle of water? I'll buy.
Yeah.
And I go, pussy, and walk away. And I'm like, all right, dude, whatever. They just don't know what they're doing, you know?
Yeah. Nah, I mean, you're exactly right. And yep. So it's so yeah, I mean, it just, I mean, as sad as it is, I mean, I was straight edge. It's funny. I was thinking about this the other day. I am quickly approaching
58 years old.
No, I'm quickly approaching the time where actually, no, that's not the case. I guess I was thinking from the day that I actually said I was straight edge until the time that I stopped was a period of about 15 years. Mm. And I'm right at that same point, almost at that same point where now I've said, okay, I drink to the point where the time
your second 15, your second 15 year period.
Yeah, baby.
Got it. So you're going to go back around? You're going to go edge again?
Maybe, you never know. I don't really know. I doubt it.
Harder to kick because of that heroin thing.
Oh. Dude, I know. But there's all this methadone stuff that I keep hearing about.
Kid Rock is a song about it. Did you have any ex tattoos that you had to cover up?
I'm tattoo free, my friend.
Okay. I have a couple buddies that they were like, it's bad enough I disrespected the edge. I sure as hell can't walk around with these little X's on my cap. So they just have like a black rectangle. And I'm like, now you just look like you covered up some weird racist tattoo. And they're like, I know, there's no winning here. I should have never started.
I mean, what I like about tattoos is somebody that doesn't have them is, you know, they tell a story, most of them. And so I like the fact, I mean, I'm of the school of thought that like, if you have an edge tattoo and you're no longer edge, like it's part of your history. I mean, it was,
I agree.
Like, I think that had I not found straight edge, I might not be here.
Mm.
You know, I have, you know, it's like I quit drinking. I had drank when I was 14 and I drank such an excessive amount one day that like the only thing I could think of was to never drink again. And thankfully some dude rolled up on his skateboard the next day with like a Use It Today cassette and I was sold. You know, I was like, holy shit, we can actually not drink. This is amazing. Right. Like, let's do this. And I mean, when I was 14, when we first got into it, we were in, you know, high school. I think I was in high school. Yeah. I mean, it was like, let's figure out a way to sabotage these people and pour their beers out or, you know, smash their cigarettes into the ground or whatever. But eventually it was like, okay, you know, the violent component of it just really, you're not doing anything better. That's for sure.
Two rights don't make a wrong.
Exactly.
You want to talk about Crime Kitchen? Go ahead, man. I got all the time in the world, but I doesn't matter. It's up to you.
Yeah,
I'll edit all this together. I'm going to cut out that straight edge, my side of the story too, because who gives a shit?
Yeah.
That's part of the problem. It's not a problem with this podcast, but the format, I understand what you're saying, where it comes into like, for instance, let's say I work my 8-hour job, where I put in an hour worth of overtime. I have 9 hours. I have days where I could listen to a podcast for 5 or 6 hours of that.
Right.
I'm running out of time. Like I have to start juggling. Like this dude's an hour and a half. This dude's 2 hours. This one's all right. This one's a half hour long. I'll squeeze that one in. Yeah, right. Start like jockeying them around. Eventually, it's almost like I picture it as like the fall schedule for a cable station, where it's like we're full. I don't know where to put you. You know.
Well, totally. And it's interesting in developing the network because I want to listen to the shows, right? Sure. And you know, at
you
this
better.
Point, well, and the interesting thing is all of the shows within the network. I mean, we came in with 8 and we developed 2. So the 8 that were already there, I was listening to. I mean, mm-hmm. That's how this thing came together. I wasn't the sole person to bring them all together, but, right. You know, we had Bad Christian and Break It Down, which are both Matt Carter's, and they're both great. Mm-hmm. Ray Harkins, who I really like his. He's got great guests. He gets them to talk about their lives and their stories, which I think is remarkable.
Right.
You've got Metal Sucks, which, you know, that one was funny. Like I met those dudes at South by, I mean, I know the guys who run the blog Metal Sucks. And when they had the podcast, I was like, how is this not the same people? That it like confused me that there was these two random dudes that
I didn't even realize that was different people.
Right. So it is, it's different people. These are the hosts, the guys who own it and run it and write for it are different people.
Huh.
But when I was at South by Southwest, because until recently they were both of the hosts of the podcast were based in Austin, you know, and they're big on Twitter, which I guess is like a podcast thing. You got to be big on Twitter. Yeah, you're shrugging your shoulders like, dog, I ain't got to be big on Twitter, yo.
Yeah,
but
I don't have 50,000 listeners either. So.
Exactly. But I tweeted at them that my goal of South by was to meet them. But I just, again, sort of for the same reason that I like many of them is, you know, they're entertaining. I mean, yeah. They're entertaining and they good guests.
They get great guests.
You know, and then Washed Up Emo I like. I've known Tom, the host of that, for a long time. And I think he's doing an interesting thing.
Yeah.
In, you know, retracing those like
a little bit genre specific. I like that. Narrow it down. I like Chuck and Godless because there's so much metal out there that is you're listening to you know, freaking Stab You in the Eye 69, it's 666. Everything's extreme and metal, and I feel like, you know, hang on a minute, I'm gonna pop my monster. And I'm like, you know, there's a lot of metalheads out there that are embarrassed by you, and I really wish you'd stop acting like that. And Chuck and Godless don't come across like that. They're just kind of like, hey, we're here to talk about metal, we got this dude on, let's talk about this. There isn't any of like that Morning Zoo vibe that a lot of metal people have. God, get away from that stuff, metal folks. You sound
which
like
is interesting because Chuck is actually like a radio host. Like that's what he does for a living. Is he works for a radio station and like hosts shows?
Does he act like that on his radio show?
Never heard one of them.
Me neither. I didn't know that.
But. And then Godless is just a fucking ball buster. I mean, he is like he's the dude who's like. He's trying to get you to talk. He's trying to get the exclusive. He's trying to butter you up. You know, let Chuck butter you up. Chuck's got that nice, soothing, deep voice. Hey,
voice, yeah.
This is Chuck, and I've got the beard to prove it. And then you got Godless. You'll love it. So I speak on a panel at South by Southwest, and Godless and I were tweeting back and forth. And, you know, he's like, hey, I'll meet you outside of your panel. So I come outside, and I meet him, and he's just – I mean, dude, he's like an accountant. He's dressed in like a pink button down shirt. He's got, you know, a totally normal mid 40s guy haircut.
I love that. You'd expect him to have a mohawk and a safety pin through his ears.
Yeah. No, dude. What I expected is I said, where's your ponytail? I'm like, because the way that you host that show to me is okay. You are a ponytail metalhead, motherfucker.
Gotcha. Like a skillet. Like a.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, like business in the front. Party
metal in the back.
Yeah, like let's do this. But he's such a rad guy. I mean, he and I have become, you know, relatively good acquaintances, and he's just a really smart dude.
Cool.
And I think that's, you know, a huge part of all of this is, you know, with the bands, I still love what I do with the artists. And I think a lot of people are like, well, how, you know, what are you doing? Is this your future? And I'm like, no, it just as Crime Kitchen does, which I'll talk about next, it weaves in with all of what I do. And I think the thread that's sewn through all of the things that I do and how I approach my life and my business, I'm trying to help people. Like, I feel as if my skill set allows me to, I'm hyper organized, I'm very driven, I can communicate, I can get people in touch with people. And like, that in and of itself is like a skill set. Mm-hmm. And a lot of artists aren't wired that way necessarily. And so I feel as if, you know, just as my relationship with Issa in Good Clean Fun, you know, I couldn't play music. He allowed me to, you know, figure out how to do that a little bit and play on stages throughout the world. And I helped him organize, you know, these trips all around the world. You mm-hmm. know, it's not to say he couldn't have done it without me, but he would have had to sacrifice his creativity in some capacity in order to do it.
Yeah, you got to stop doing something to do this.
Yeah.
You're not running Outer Loop right now because you're talking to me.
Yeah, exactly. Thankfully, let's edit that part out.
I'm sorry. I mean, you're constantly running Outer Loop. And
I got my email and text messages running in the background, and my empire is – but so, yeah – I enjoy helping people. And so interestingly, Crime Kitchen came about because Darkest Hour's tour manager, a guy named Tito, who has worked for them for a really long time, okay. really awesome dude, you know, not like the Mike Mowry college graduate tour manager, more like the, I grew up in, you know, a metal house, or, you know, I grew up in a household that allowed me to listen to metal. I smoke a lot of weed, but I'm a really good person and I'm going to fucking help out in any way that I can. Okay. That style of tour management.
So I love those guys.
I do too.
Yeah.
And he's got a heart of fucking gold. You know, if I ever needed anything out of this guy, he would do it, you know, no matter what, not because he owes me anything. It's because he's a fucking genuine good dude.
Sure.
So at some point as dubstep, you know, kind of started getting popular, the whole Skrillex and all that stuff.
Sure.
He was like, he's like, look, I really enjoy this kind of music. You know, is there any way that we could manage some of these types of artists? I know a few of them and I can't, you know, I don't really know what it takes to manage, but can we start to do some of that? And so I was like, look, dude, I can sense your passion for it. As a former tour manager who wanted to figure out an exit strategy from the business and was able to do so on my own, I'd like to be able to give you this opportunity. Let's try to manage some of these small developing artists. Hard part with that world in particular is at the early stages of EDM, which Crime Kitchen is an EDM label. I don't think we mentioned that, but
okay.
This was pre-Crime Kitchen. This was Outer Loop management, Tito bringing artists in, trying to manage them is they really need shows. I mean, that world is all about delivering music and playing shows.
Okay.
And so as much as you can be a manager, like without those things, there ain't much to manage, you know?
Okay.
And so we tried it, but then we spent a lot of time trying to convince people to book the artists, and there's so much, you know, there's so many artists in that realm. It wasn't really working necessarily.
Is merch? I'm sorry, you're on a stream of consciousness, and I'm gonna kink it. Is merchandise and format as big in the EDM world? I mean, you're talking so far out of my jurisdiction here. Like, are they worried about pressing vinyl and all that kind of stuff?
No, not really.
Yeah, that's like not
their thing. Unless you cross over into being like a mainstream artist and merchandise. Sure. You know, in terms of t-shirts, not really either. I mean, the thing is, it depends on how big of an artist you are. A lot of the world is like soft tickets. So the difference between a soft ticket and a hard ticket is, let's say Electric Factory. I'm just going to use that because it's a Philadelphia-based venue.
I know it well. Sure.
All right. So let's say Refused comes and plays the Electric Factory. It says Refused is playing, blah, blah, blah. That's a hard ticket. If you want to go see Refused, you're buying the ticket based on Refused. Now, yeah. Let's say there's
Token EDM night at Electric Factory every Thursday. And you're now featuring DJ Dennis Lixon, the singer of Refused. And this is actually a kind of a bad example because he still has a name. But let's say you're just random DJ, right?
Okay.
Playing that night. That's a soft ticket for him because the night is already established. You've got people that are going to go to the EDM show almost regardless of who's playing.
Got it.
Right? That said, they build the night based on delivering consistently delivering great talent. But at some point in that world, the artist makes the jump from I'm no longer a soft ticket guy, meaning I can go out on my own.
Now you're coming to see me.
You're coming to see me.
Gotcha. So exactly. I didn't go see Refused because it was Electric Factory's Friday night Swedish punk hardcore night.
Correct. Right. No,
I bought a ticket based on the band I want to see. Okay. All right. Right on. I had hard ticket, soft ticket, never even heard that term.
In our world, like the punk, rock, metal world, like there's no such thing really.
Interesting.
It doesn't exist. This is something that, I've learned through this process and through being in the business. But anyways, on the way it all happens is, We were having a hard time getting these artists the opportunities. There wasn't anything to manage. Like they had some content going out, but they weren't necessarily – we didn't have the relationships, nor did they necessarily have the talent. And I won't really say talent because they may – like that's a very subjective thing. But – we weren't able to get them to have the releases on these, again, going back to validation. There's certain labels within the EDM sphere that instantly validate you. It doesn't mean you're going to become massive, but sort of like going back to soft tickets, there's certain labels that if you're released on it, people are paying attention, just as in metal. I mean, hey, if Nuclear Blast released your record, people are going to check it out versus if, you release your record on your own and it happens to be just as good as the latest Nuclear Blast release, you might completely disappear into obscurity.
Not might.
Yeah. Most likely you will.
It's that message in a bottle.
And there's exceptions to every rule.
Out into the ocean, like I might find it, but holy shit. Bandcamp is like, it's Tuesday. Here's 7 billion new albums. I don't know where to start.
Totally.
Yeah.
So in a very like fortuitous, and this again, it's just interesting, like how this conversation sort of weaves and ebbs and flows. And I talk about, to me, my value to the podcast network was, I can introduce this to people. And like, I take meetings. Like part of my job is to go to New York and go to LA because that's where people in the business are. And I take meetings. Sometimes they're very specific. I say, hey, Joe at Label Z, we got to talk about band Y. And at the end of that, or at the beginning of it, we talk about all the other things that we're doing. And so podcast networks come up or EDM labels come up or whatever it may be. And so a lot of the people that I deal with are attorneys. Attorneys are the people that, do the legal stuff. No, I'm kidding. Attorneys are, usually connected people. Really? And more than almost everyone else, they can be incredibly diverse. Mm. The law, music law, is almost the same across most genres. There's different deal points, of course, based on, probably the discrepancies within the genre, but generally you're talking about royalties, you're talking about rights, you're talking about all this stuff. And so whether you're talking about a country artist, an EDM artist, a rock artist, a metal artist, those are usually the same. So attorneys more than anyone, I think, can really, and managers, I mean, I guess everyone has that ability. I mean, I predominantly am known for doing metal, but I always like to say I can, I know all the people in that world and, the Warped Tour world, but like I can manage anybody. Mm-hmm. Management is a skill in and of itself. And regardless of what type of music you're playing, I can do that. I can open doors. I can make connections. I can guide you and set the goals and achieve the goals for your career. Okay. Right. Long story, getting even longer. I'm in New York. I'm talking to an attorney who represents Ice Nine Kills.
Okay.
I go see him almost every time I'm up there. I was telling him about the stuff that we were doing with the electronic management, telling him I wasn't really sure how it was going, but, you know, we're still doing it. And he just says, hey, do you have an extra 15 minutes? I say, sure. You know, my next meeting's in an hour. It's only 20 minutes away. I'll stay. He goes, because the next guy coming in is somebody I think you should meet. Turns out this guy is managing, and not managing like a manager. He's more managing the catalogs. So the recorded, okay, you know, masters of legacy meaning older electronic artists. So what happened is, let's say these dudes have been around for 25 years and they signed some sort of deal. And after 20 years, all of their rights revert back to them.
Okay.
Right? When they did that deal 20 years ago, they never thought that 20 years later, like, there was going to be this great internet thing that they could just put up their own music, right?
Got it.
But that's what happened. And so here's dudes with names, and I don't even know I don't even know who they are, but from dealing with, you know, this guy now, I realize that it would be like if Refused, when they got back together, decided like, hey, we don't want to have any label association. We want to do this ourselves. Like, they have the name. Going back to the joke, and I don't know if it'll make the podcast, but how the garbled bit sounded like OK Computer. Radiohead came out and released that record for Pay What You Want. Mm-hmm. They could do that because
they're
Radiohead. They have that branding. Uh-huh. And so they could do whatever they want. So Radiohead, yes, they quote unquote did it on their own, but they surely had a manager and a team of people,
of course,
that were managing that catalog. And mm-hmm. So this dude, Bill, was looking for some younger people to get involved with on the younger side of electronic music. Turns out Bill, who's about 10 years older than I am, used to produce metal records in New Jersey in the late 80s and 90s before he went and did a bunch of major label stuff. And so here we are, a bunch of fucking degenerate metal related dudes who are trying to do something in electronic music. And he's like, I'm in. And so we all sit down and determine that, like, okay, the management thing is something that we can still do, and we can do it under Outer Loop if indeed we want to do EDM. And I do some EDM stuff managerially. I have a young guy who works for me that is awesome in that field. But the stuff with Tito, Darkest Hour's tour manager, transitioned more into a label because what we realized was we need to build some sort of brand that can, again, validate these artists. So taking these artists and somehow allowing their music to get out to the world. Now, whether we've been successful in that or not just yet remains to be seen. None of our bank accounts are, you know, reflecting that we've been successful, but the idea is there.
Right.
And just, you know, it's sort of the same thing. I mean, Jabberjaw, Crime Kitchen, Outer Loop Records, Outer Loop Management, to me, it's all about like helping people, putting in the work, the knowledge, everything that we have, and building the brand. And so over time, I'm hoping that all of these things grow and they continue to interweave with one another.
Kind of feed each other a little bit.
Yeah. And whether they directly feed each other or the only way that they feed each other is that Mike Mowry is having a conversation, or any one of my, you know, Bill, who's the GM of Crime Kitchen, or Tito, who's the tour manager that I talked about, who, you know, is an A&R guy. He's out having a conversation with a signed EDM artist. The guy's already got a label. He's already got management. And the only conversation is the guy says, I really just want to start a podcast. And all of a sudden Tito says, well, shit, Mike Mowry, you know, one of the guys who's involved with Crime Kitchen, he's got this Jabberjaw network. Like, why don't we do a podcast with you?
Got it.
You know, or any one of these things, because to me, they're all formats, they're all media, they're all related. And it's interesting that they're kind of like in these separate little avenues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, the goal is, as it continues on, is that they will all sort of tie together a little bit more. But I know that it just takes time for that stuff to actually happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Have I bored you yet?
You still talk? I stopped recording about 45 minutes ago because my terabyte hard drive is full.
I mean, dude, anytime that I talk to somebody more than Ryan Downey did, fucking
Downey.
That right there is like a feat in and of itself.
This is what we do here at As the Story Grows. Steven isn't with us today because he had hand surgery and he's probably laying around stoned right now. But this is what we do. We're trying to just have these conversations and trying to talk. I'm trying to get in the head and really honestly hear why the person gives a shit enough to come on a podcast and talk about what they're doing. I don't like talking about like, hey, where'd you buy your first guitar? Who was your first influence? Yeah. We've all heard that before. I'm like, but seriously, like, if anybody gets to the end of this conversation and still believes that Mike Mowry is just a manager who wants to get money, then you know what? You're probably not the right dude for him anyway.
Right. You know?
That's what I'm trying to do. Sometimes it takes 2 hours because you're long-winded. No, I'm kidding. But no.
Well, because I'm old, and so now I've got fucking stories.
Sure, you're old. You're prehistorically old. You have stories, and you also started looking up my whiteboard. You're including Good Clean Fun, Outer Loop Management, Records, Crime Kitchen, Warped Tour, Jabberjaw All Media. Yeah, I mean, you know, it takes a while to cover all that stuff. If we wanted to just talk about Crime Kitchen, yeah, I could have made this a 40-minute podcast, but whatever.
No, I mean, look, I'm appreciative of it, and again, I like the format, and I like that, you know, dudes like Downey, who I know really well.
Right.
I know probably 90% of his story. There's some 10% that, you know, you bring out of him. Again, for whatever reason, it's because we're on this thing. You know, you're sitting there with your beautiful backdrop in the background. You know, you got your spit shield over your microphone, and it's like,
it's called a pop filter. It's not a spit shield.
I want to tell this guy everything.
Welcome to As the Story Grows. Come inside, get comfortable.
So how and when and why did you decide to start the podcast?
Well, I don't know who the hell you think you are, just hijacking and taking over. I'm in Jabberjaw Media, so now I'll just interview you. All right. My name's Trav, and I started getting into podcasts about
sorry, you're breaking up. Gotta go.
Yeah, right. Hang on. I gotta pee. I'll be right back.
Hold on. My wife's calling, and I actually want to take it this time. We're done talking about me. Yeah, I gotta go, bro.
Yeah. I don't
care. All right. Anyways, so you're a podcaster?
I started getting into podcasts.
So you must be really rich.
Oh yeah. I'm independently wealthy. I just work for fun. Because I like to kill some time. I don't want to be home all the time and relaxing. I like to get up early. I love to get up early and work out in the cold. I will love working outside.
Around chemicals.
When it's -6, wind chill. And I do love inhaling chemicals when the wind blows back in your face. That's one of my favorite things. I got into podcasting because I play drums. And I tried out for a band locally. I'm 40 years old and still like playing out. I don't know what the hell's wrong with me, especially drums. Ugh, there's so much equipment to drag around. I went and tried out for a band, and I got the gig. And I was like, well, cool, but I'm supposed to be on a podcast tonight. So, like, I'll get back to you. Switch. And this cat named Jesse, who runs Veritas Vinyl, small label out in Colorado, we got to be buddies. I was doing some correspondence drumming with him, and he was like, "Will you come on as a guest host?" Because he was talking. Do you ever hear of a band called Crux?
Yeah,
Greg from Crux was his co-host, and Greg couldn't do it anymore because of his job. So he was like, "Will you come on my podcast with me?" And I was like, "Never done it before. Sure, I'll try it." Loved it. Right. Absolutely had such a blast just talking to me about music and everything like that. And I just felt like this was a lot of fun. And then he asked me to like be his co-host. And then he got busy with his work and he was like, here, do you want to just take the podcast? And I was like, yes, I do. Because I hear a lot of music podcasts that are like, Mowry, tell me about the drunkest time. Remember this chick behind the woo. And I just felt like that's such a dumb format. I like how Mark Maron
sits down and like intimately, like you're in my garage, have a coffee, let's talk and really talk, like intimately talk. And I feel like I have a good personality for it. So I figured I'd go for it. And
you're definitely a great listener. I will say that.
What? I'm paying attention because this, if you were talking to me about surfing,
right,
you'd probably catch me picking my nose and kind of glancing at how much spackle work I have to do in my studio. But music is like, I've been playing drums since I was a kid, and I grew up with the same crap you all listen to, and metalhead, punk guy, hardcore, blah, yeah, whatever. This is like we talked about the spinal cord. This is, as long as it's music centric, I'm paying attention. When you're tired.
I know. God, it's only like 5 o'clock. But dude, I'm in Boston and it's pitch dark.
I know, dude. Yeah, I think I have that seasonal onset whatever.
Sad. Seasonal.
Sad. Dude, it's, I'm sitting on my couch and I'm nodding off and I'm like, oh my God, it's so far past my bedtime. I have to sleep. And I look at my phone, it's like 6:50.
Dude,
my circadian rhythms are like
completely. Yeah, well, my wife and I were driving up yesterday. You know, we drove from DC up to Albany, and like we left, yeah, like 1 o'clock. And by the time we were like almost off the Jersey Turnpike, it was pitch black. And I'm like, dude, is it like, were we in traffic or something? Like, how is it 8 at night? She's like, it's 4:37.
I know. I know. Watching a football game at my neighbor's house last week, and it was like, well, man, I'm getting awfully tired. I guess it's time to start going. And it was like, we're halfway through the middle game. It was like 6 o'clock, and I was like, I probably got to get home and start making my smoothies and stuff. Yeah, I got to get to bed. Oh, I'm not going to bed for 4 more hours. What am I doing? It's a mess, dude.
Oh, totally. Sweet. You know what's so awesome about this is I just got a Verizon alert that
oh, you're over your
magically I'm approaching or over my data. How hilarious is that?
I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. I just never even thought of it. Like I didn't think that we're dealing with that much data. Thanks. We are the
And when did your plan re-ups at the beginning of the month?
Yeah.
Oh, dude, we just murdered your plan for the month.
It's all right. I'm a baller. I own like 8 businesses. Like, I'll just, you know, I'm just gonna like, you know, just gonna walk into Verizon and buy it tomorrow. Like, from my cracked screen on my iPhone.
Reach down onto your Batman belt and pull another iPhone out. I'll just start using this one.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I guess that's the cue to actually go.
Got it. Talk about Batman. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. This was fun. Awesome.
So, happy Thanksgiving, Mr. Mowry.
Same to you, brother. Nice to meet you.
Later, bro.
All right. Bye. Deformed genitalia. Whatever, dude. Mm-hmm. This is all you got.
Just stop. Stop talking.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.